just reflect on the prayers that come up in the healing stories. They're nice and short. That's something to say about a prayer. It's an advantage, it seems to me, to have a short prayer. Remember, I saw one once, maybe you've seen this little poster, and it says, when you're feeling really down and out, like the whole world's against you, and you just don't have any more energy at all, and you can't even imagine facing tomorrow, this is the prayer. Help! Help! Well, it's just nice. As you know, the Gospel of Mark, at least the first half of it, up until the first 10 chapters, are just filled with miracle stories and healing stories. And in some cases, it's wonderful that it seems as if Jesus just takes the healing on even without a request, which is interesting. We'll look at that. In the case, the first healing, for instance, the cure of the demoniac in Mark chapter 1. If you want to look at your text there. We're going to look at that text later,
40-45, that healing of the leper.
Beginning with 21 there.
Excuse me.
Yeah, 21.
Last Sunday's Gospel.
But there it seems to me the man does not ask for a healing because he's not in charge. There's a demon. Mm-hmm. You know, and so Jesus makes that a step forward. And the same is true with Simon's mother-in-law. There's no request there. They told her. They, it says, immediately told him about her. So it's a intercession for healing on the behalf of someone else. So it's just nice. You can learn a lot about prayers here. After, of course, and then the whole healing in the evening after the Sabbath. So all the people caught on to this and brought all their people they loved. Be interesting just to see what that scene would have looked like as a prayer. When it was evening after sunset, they brought to him all who were ill or possessed by spirits. The whole town was gathered at the door. Can you picture yourself among them? Standing, invoking him just by your very presence. We'll look more at those stories as the talk goes on, but I'd like to begin with two Roman Catholic jokes, I suppose we could say these are. You know, we all learn the Our Father as Christians, and we share that prayer, but you could tell me a prayer that's real special to Catholics. It's that prayer.
The Hail Mary.
Yes, I grew up as a little kid learning and saying the Hail Mary, and I suspect that when I'm in a real pinch, that's a prayer I'll probably say. And my grandfather, for years, was a fallen away Catholic, and I didn't know it. My mother never really let on, you know. But years later, he broke his hip, and so he had an operation. And my grandmother, who was very prayerful, and she played her cards as fervently as she went to masks, you know, she was a good Belgian Catholic. Well, my grandfather, though, was Bohemian. And it was quite an intellectual, and never thought too much about the rosary, in fact. Said he didn't find much pleasure, actually, in just repeating that prayer. But when he came out of surgery from his hip being repaired, he was saying the Hail Mary in Bohemian, which he probably hadn't done since he was about 6 years old. It's just interesting that his psyche, maybe he didn't pray it, but his psyche came forth, and that's the prayer he was saying when he came out of surgery. At any rate,
one of those prayers, a wonderful prayer, is the Angelus, as you maybe know, where you have that little verse from Scripture, the angel of the Lord declared unto Mary, and then there's a pause. So that the ringing in the Angelus in a Catholic church, there's a ringing of the bell, and then there's a little pause, and you say the Hail Mary, and then there's a ringing of the bell, and you say Hail Mary. And then there's a longer prayer at the end, and then when we were novices, we used to ring the bell in our convent belfry, and that would go on for about 20 strokes, you know. So, and at 6 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock at night. Well, they tell the story of a man who had been away from the church for years and years and years, and somehow decided to make a turnaround, and as my mother said, she has this expression, closing the books, you know. So he decided he needed to make his peace, so he came to church, and it was a Saturday afternoon, and it was very, very late. And the confessionals, as you know, in the Catholic Church have been changed into reconciliation rooms, you know. Well, that was a whole new wrinkle for him, and so it took him a while to kind of adjust, but he waited to be the last one. He went in, and he sat down, and he told Father really what amounted to be his life story. And so then Father said, well, he said, I think for your penance it'd be good to just read the story in the Bible of the prodigal son returned. And the man said, oh, he said, Father, I don't have a Bible. He said, I haven't had a Bible for years and years. He said, I wouldn't know where to find that in the Bible, you know. So Father kind of waited. He said, well, why don't you just say the Our Father then? That'll be a nice kind of reconciliation prayer, you know. He said, oh, he said, Father, I haven't said the Our Father. He said, I don't know the Our Father. And I said, well, how about the Hail Mary? He said, well, he said, I don't think I could get through the Hail Mary either. Well, Father was getting a little strung out himself. So finally, the man said, but I know the Angelus. And Father said, that's fine. You say the Angelus. So the man got up and left. And Father kind of thought for a moment. He thought, well, that's strange. So thought he'd follow the man, because the man had gone out of the room in the back of the church, and he walked all the way up to the front, and he knelt down right at the communion rail, right there at the front. And so the priest thought, I'm going to go follow him and see whether, you know, what happens here, you know. So the priest kind of went up the aisle and slid into the pew, and the man very reverently put his head down, and he went, bong! She said it, so. Some prayers can be real simple, you know. So wonderful prayers, so a stretching prayer, you know, exercise prayer. Well, the other story I have to tell you is a real true story. I told you, I maybe shared with some of you, that I was a sister for many years. And this is a story that comes actually from one of our convents in the Chicago area, where, again, when we had servers and they learned the Latin, it was pretty difficult for a little guy to learn that in third or fourth grade. And so we'd usually start them out by having them come to the convent mass at 6 o'clock in the morning. So that's where they'd kind of do it the first time and kind of get used to that before we let them serve mass over in the church. And so this little guy, it was his first time he said mass, and of course there were certain things he was supposed to do, and he was all excited, you know, and it was always kind of fun to see how excited they got. And there he was in the inner sanctum of the convent in our little chapel. Anyway, the little guy came in, and mass began, and all of a sudden he must have realized at offertory mass a time that he forgot to bring the little bell, because all we, you know, during the Catholic services we used to be ringing bells all the time, you know. Well, so that went by, but the real important time was when it came to the consecration of the mass, and the father used to genuflect, and then he'd hold the chalice up, and the server was supposed to ring the bell. Well, it came to that part of the mass, and of course we knew he didn't have the bell, so we're all praying away there, and all of a sudden Father genuflects, he holds the chalice up, and the little guy says, ding-a-ling-a-ling. That is my favorite story. I mean, ding-a-ling-a-ling, you know. Well, the sisters said they could barely contain themselves. This little guy was trying to make up for it. Well, I want to talk to you actually about four things in this session, or deal with four things with your help. The first is to give you some data on the illnesses and diseases at the time of Jesus. Some of the work, recent work that's being done along that line, kind of a social sociological analysis. Just to give you some facts on that, and then contrast that with the situation that we're in today. And secondly, I'd like to share with you then some analysis by a social scientist of the difference of looking at illness in the time of Jesus and in many other traditional societies, and then in our own society. Share some of that recent research with you. And then look at healing in Mark. What's the distinctive quality of healing, or the what's called the healthcare system in the Gospel of Mark, as distinguished, say, from Matthew and Luke and John. And then finally, to do some work together on some stories of healing that can be applied to men and women, and to all of us, actually, some material there. So that's what I have in mind here. I first came to some of this material a couple years ago, and it really suggests that a lot of the work on biblical criticism has been done from a linguistic or a literary point of view, and we really haven't got a very good sense of the facts of the first century. So I'm going to read you some of these. I think they're just astounding. I'd like to get some of your reaction to this. A person of 84 years, remember in the Gospel of Luke, Anna, the prophetess, is said to be 84 years old. That would be highly unusual for anyone to live that long. In cities of antiquity, nearly a third of the live births were dead before age 6. If you had three children, one of live births, huh? That's not even counting those who died at birth or were born stillborn. So one out of three would be dead by the age 6. By the mid-teens, 60% would have died. By the mid-20s, 75%. And 90% by the mid-40s. So one out of nine people would survive to their mid-40s. Perhaps 3% reach their 60s. Few poor people lived out their 30s. The ancient glorification of youth and veneration of the elderly, who in non-literate societies are the only repository of community memory and knowledge, are thus easily understood. Moreover, we can note that much of Jesus' own audience would have been younger than he, disease-ridden and looking at a decade or less of life expectancy. When you think of all the wonderful pictures we have of Jesus, you know, the statues and so on. Now, thinking about the health that Jesus would have had at the age 30. This scholar says, by age 30, health for most persons would have been atrocious. Teeth were frequently rotted, eyesight gone, and the effects of protein deficiency, internal parasites, and poor diet were evident. That's from Richard Rohrbach, has done some of that work. And this is actually, I'm taking this from an article that will appear in a book called Social History of the Matthean Community, Cross-Disciplinary Approaches to an Open Question. And the editor of that is David Belch, B-A-L-C-H, and it's coming out of Fortress Press. And this, I first heard this paper when it was given down at a conference on the Gospel of Matthew. And it's from Rodney Stark, who at that time was at the University of Washington. And it's a paper about the city of Antioch, actually, but he talks about ancient cities then at the time of Christ. And what he says, there's lots of interesting things here, like the just how crowded ancient cities were. For instance, it would be common for a city to be because they built them as fortresses many times, so they had these walls going around them, and they might be
just a mile, square mile, and yet they would have thousands and thousands and thousands of people living in these cities. Now you can imagine the squalor that would come out of that. Gives you some example of this. Says, given the population, the area of the city, it is easily calculated that the population density of Antioch was roughly 75 inhabitants per square mile, or 17 people per acre. As a comparison, in Chicago today, there are 21 inhabitants per acre. San Francisco has 23. New York City overall has 37. But then remember that in New York, we're talking high buildings. For them, because they had to be really careful because of what they could do, their buildings were maybe 5 stories high tops. So what he argues is that very few people would have spent much time at home because it would have been really such a bad place to be. And that's not counting, say, the animals that would have been living with you in those places. It's really, he says, most people lived in tiny cubicles in multi-storied tenements in conditions wherein privacy was a hard thing to find. The streets would be so narrow that you could talk to people living in the next building without raising your voice, and it'd be really right there. Anyway, he talks then about the health. He said the Greco-Roman city was a pestle of infectious disease because it was always thus in cities. Indeed, it was not until the 20th century that urban mortality was sufficiently reduced so that the cities of Western Europe and North America could sustain their populations without additional immigration from rural areas. If this is true of modern cities, think of what it must have been in places like Rome and Antioch. In fact, historical demographers agree that the average lifetime of the ancients was short. And although there have been some disagreements among those who have attempted to estimate life expectancies from Roman tomb inscriptions, none challenges that life expectancy at birth was less than 30 years, and probably substantially less. It is important to realize that where mortality rates are very high, the health of those still living is very poor. The majority of those living in Greco-Roman cities must have suffered from chronic health conditions that caused them pain and some degree of disability, and of which many would soon die. Goes on to say that, moreover, women in Greco-Roman times were especially afflicted because of chronic infections resulting from childbirth and abortion. This, combined with female infanticide, which was widely practiced in many Greco-Roman cities, resulted in highly imbalanced sex ratios, a relative shortage of adult females. It's estimated that the sex ratio of Rome at 131 males per 100 females and set the ratio of 140 for Italy and North Africa. Sociologists have recently come to recognize that sex ratios greatly influence sex roles. To the extent that males outnumber females, women will be enclosed in more restrictive sex roles, as in the case of ancient Athens. Conversely, to the extent that women outnumber men, they will enjoy substantially greater freedom and equality, as in the case of ancient Sparta. That males probably far outnumbered females in Antioch, at least into the second century, ought to have influenced the gender roles that one of the other professors talked about in the Gospel of Matthew. So it gives you, and he goes into quite detail of what say the lack of sanitation and what that would have been like, and again it kind of puts you into the nitty-gritty of the text and see how we somehow idealize these scenes. I mean, we sanitize them instead of really beginning to see that healing would have been so important because illness and disease were so rampant that you wouldn't have been able to walk down the street without seeing many people ill and diseased. That would have been a common everyday. I suppose it's what we associated with a city like Calcutta and Mother Teresa. It would have been a really common occurrence. Now, it struck me that we might contrast then what it is like for us and where we are. This was an article that was in the Seattle Times last February by Daniel Callahan, who you probably recognize as he's the director of the Hastings Center in New York research. It says, forget old brand, forget even cholesterol. Chocolate sundaes are good for you and fatty steaks even better. Or maybe that was true last month, but not this month. This month, the word is that the asbestos we have been spending millions to remove from pipes and insulation might not be so hazardous after all. And what we thought wonderful for us, fluoridated water, may have spared our teeth but exposed us to cancer. Just what the truth is here, I cannot pretend to know. The line between humor and seriousness has become a fine one. The border between joke and scientific fact, a battlefield of competing information. What I do know is that we seem breathless to get the latest word. We, the healthiest people in the history of the human race, have made our health the state of our body an obsession. We act as if a failure to get the right information on oats or asbestos or salt will make the difference between life and death. I remember Arlo's, you know that cartoon, that comic strip Arlo's? It's kind of an interesting one, but I remember in one of the cartoon strips, his wife was making sure that he was eating oat bran in a certain amount and so on, and at some point he turned and he said, well, how long are we going to live anyway? How long are you planning this, that we're going to kind of live forever by doing all the right things? And what a burden it is then when people get sick that they think, you know, I ate something I shouldn't have eaten. You know? As if it comes down to those. He goes on, of course, to say that we're just spending millions and millions of dollars for, quote, that quality care, which extends life. Most of the health dollars go for the first 6 months and for the last 6 months of life. So it's just, seem to be control issues for us. So it's just nice to get a kind of piece of where we are on that and where the ancients are as we read, I think, these texts here. The other piece that's so interesting to me is the work that's coming out, as I said, on sociological studies. And along that line, there are a number of articles that I can direct you to. John Pilch, P-I-L-C-H, has been doing a number of studies that have been appearing again in that Biblical Theology Bulletin. And I'm going to read a summary of some of that material, but to give you an idea of some of the articles that he's been writing, there's one called Healing in Mark, a Social Science Analysis, and I'll use some of that today. Then he has another one called The Health Care System in Matthew, a Social Science Analysis, and then Understanding Biblical Healing, Selecting the Appropriate Model. And what he begins with is, well, I didn't write this down. Well, that's all right. I can just tell you. He distinguishes between ethno-medical thinking, ethno meaning that you relate it to the culture, and biomedical, which is what we're used to. You use biology to trace the causes of a disease, identify it, you test for it, and so on, and then you describe a remedy. So that's what we're working at, the difference between looking at the meaning that is given within a culture to illness, as over against our way of going at it. I remember a program, watching a program that said that modern science is the successes of modern science really come out of the thinking of a body as a machine with movable parts, and that each part can be dealt with separately as a way to deal with health issues.
Well, what Pilch does is then look at those texts, and of course there are two ways you can, if you look at it from the outside, that's called by anthropologists etic, E-T-I-C. It means that you're an outsider looking into the system. And of course, it makes a difference then in a certain sense of how you go about it and how easy it is for us, knowing certain things, to project that back into the text, and then how dangerous that really is. And then there's emic, which is E-M-I-C, meaning you're in the system. So the texts that we have, of course, are written by people who are in the system. They're not outsiders, they're in that system as they're describing it. So let me just share this nice little summary for you. It says, in the contemporary world, we view disease as a malfunction of the organism that can be remedied, assuming cause and cure are known by proper biomedical treatment. We focus on restoring a sick person's ability to function, to do. Yet often overlooked is the fact that health and sickness are culturally defined, and that in the ancient Mediterranean, being was more important than doing. The healers of that world thus focused on restoring a person to a valued state of being rather than an ability to function. I was thinking how many of us, when we get sick, you know, we call in, that's what we say, we call in sick. We can't be in to do whatever we're supposed to be doing that day. So we're, that's how we interpret it. No, so we don't use the word ill. We don't call in ill, we call in sick. And many times the anthropologists then make the difference between illness, which relates to more than just your sickness, it involves other people, and sickness, which is kind of a personal state of your health. You say, I'm sick, okay. But illness refers to other things that happens. You're laid up, you know, and it affects your family and insurance and that sort of thing. It comes along. Anthropologists just thus distinguish between disease, a biomedical malfunction, and illness, a disvalued state of being in which social networks have been disrupted and meaning lost. Illness is not so much a biomedical matter as it is a social one. It is attributed to social, not physical causes. Thus, sin and sickness, in our text, go together. Illness is a matter of deviance from cultural norms and values. In our society, a leper may be unable to function. In ancient Palestine, a leper was unclean and was to be excluded from the community. The blind, the lame, malformed, and those with itching scabs, crushed testicles, or injured limbs were not permitted to draw near the altar. What is described in the New Testament, therefore, is not so much diseases as illnesses, abnormal sociological or sociocultural human conditions, some of which would have had a basis in a physical condition, and others which did not. Maybe I didn't read that right. What is described in the New Testament, therefore, is not so much diseases as illnesses, abnormal sociocultural human conditions. And therefore, Jesus would be relating to those, not therefore as a doctor. Even in the ancient world, they had healers were divided into kind of the professional healers. And actually, there are only seven texts that refer, say, in Mark. I think it's not even just in Mark, it might be in the whole New Testament, to professional physicians. And then there would be the, let's see, he has it here, the folk healers, that would be the, what Jesus would have been, would be the folk healers. And then there's another category that he refers to here. Let's see. There's a professional, the popular sector would be the other. So those would be kind of the professional, and then the popular, and then the folk healer. He says, folk healers were more commonly available to peasants, and Jesus appears as such in the Gospels. He is a spirit-filled prophet
who vanquishes unclean spirits and a variety of illnesses and restores people to their place in the community. Such folk healers accept all symptoms as important and see a direct relation between symptoms and belief systems. A refocusing of one's meaning in life, metanoia, is essential to healing illness. Community acceptance of folk healers is essential, and where you would not be accepted, you would not be able to perform, as say in Jesus' hometown, if you remember. He was not able to cure there because they did not accept him as a folk healer. One of the things that oftentimes can bring this into focus, or the difference between the two systems, would be, say, the issue of leprosy. And even the term that's often translated, it's a real problem, since the word leper, in our English translations, really is not the technical disease that we know as Hansen's disease. That most of the things referred to as leprosy would have been skin diseases within that community. The bacteria, or bacterium, that causes leprosy was only discovered in the year 1868. So that there's no way that they could have been dealing with that as a biomedical disease. So you can see then that the way they dealt with illness or diseases was really in terms of its meaning, what you might call a hermeneutical model. And it's in that way that we need to then see what happens in the healing stories of Jesus. For instance, if the community thought that skin diseases were contagious, if that's what they thought, and it was because the disease was contagious that you were put outside the community, then why was it that people who had that could approach Jesus? You see, it seems more that it's a cultural way of dealing with that, say, skin diseases, as they would call it. And it had not a medical reason to it. It was a cultural meaning. And it makes you wonder whether there isn't a projection that's occurring there. That the people who had these kind of knowable diseases, I mean, it was so obvious, we could see you had a skin disease of some kind, that you then become a scapegoat for the community. So part of the community then gets rid of that sense, if you will, that something's wrong, and so it's projected out there. And then you wonder whether Jesus bringing that person back into the community isn't a lesson to that community. In the Gospel of Mark particularly, it's really strong where the text is, in chapter 7, the beginning of chapter 7, if you have your text there. It would really be a strong text along this line of Jesus on how he deals with illness or disease. It says, "Now when the Pharisees with some scribes who had come from Jerusalem gathered around him, they observed that some of his disciples ate their meals with unclean, that is, unwashed hands. For the Pharisees, and in fact all Jews, do not eat without carefully washing their hands, keeping the tradition of the elders. And on coming from the marketplace, they do not eat without purifying themselves. And there are many other things that they have traditionally observed, the purification of cups and jugs and kettles and beds," it says. "So the Pharisees and scribes questioned Jesus, 'Why do your disciples not follow the tradition of the elders, but instead eat a meal with unclean hands?' He responded, 'Well did Isaiah prophesy about you hypocrites, as it is written, "This people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines human precepts." you disregard God's commandment but cling to human tradition. He went on to say, how well you have set aside the commandment of God in order to uphold your tradition. Then there's a whole part there. That actually is not the text I wanted. At least it goes, that's that whole section there, I don't want to get into that. Beginning with 17. It says, when he got home, away from the crowd, his disciples questioned him about the parable. He said to them, are you even likewise without understanding? Do you not realize that everything that goes into a person from outside cannot defile? Since it enters not the heart, but the stomach, and passes out into the latrine. But what comes out of a person, that is what defiles. For within people, from their hearts, come evil thoughts, unchastity, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, licentiousness, envy, blasphemy, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from within, and they defile. And what Jesus seems to be saying then, in terms of taking someone who is ill and ostracizing them, forcing them out of the community, is to say, the illness is within community. Those are the things that break down and threaten the community, not these physical illnesses. It's a really powerful way, I think, to, in one sense, retract your projections. Talk more about that. Pilch talks about the biomedical or empirical model, the one that you and I grow up with, as having six basic steps, and I could run through these really quickly again, to try to identify where we come from as readers and where the biblical text is coming from. He says those six basic steps are the pathological entity emerges, huh? You notice something you have a swell or something like that, you have an ache, huh? So you're alert to that. That's the first. Then you seek relevant symptoms. You try to think back of whether you could have bruised it, or where it could have come from, or whether there's something in the family like that. You try to look for that. Then, of course, we go through a procedure of laboratory tests. We kind of check all of this out. You go to the doctor and you get tests done all the time. And then, of course, the fourth thing is that the doctor reads the test. He diagnoses that and tries to explain the symptoms. And then, fifth, there's an interpretive strategy where you try to connect, say, low blood sugar with what you've been saying is happening to you. And you try and make those connections. And then, sixth, there's a therapeutic goal. If you have hypoglycemia, they tell you not to eat sugar and to eat more cheese and so on, so there's a remedy to it. So we have that kind of approach to it, but oftentimes don't give the person the support system, actually. So we tend to isolate the cause and the condition and then prescribe for that. So very isolated. So that, it seems to me, a lot of people who are dealing with the meaning of the illness, which is what you deal with primarily as pastors, you don't necessarily get very much help from the medical profession on that. But in the time of Jesus, they didn't have all that expertise. And so it was precisely as hermeneutic, or the meaning of suffering, that is dealt with within the text. And what you see is Jesus always kind of pulling the community around the sick one, restoring the sick one to the community. That's a wonderful part. And it makes you wonder whether that isn't really valuable now in sharing with people today. Also, one of the things that comes out of this new literature, these new studies, is the caution that there's not just one way to interpret human sickness. I'm reminded here of a book by Susan Sontag. I don't know if you've ever read this, Illness as Metaphor, but that's just a really valuable book to read, in which she cautions using sicknesses, say as cancer, in our everyday language. You talk about the cancer in our cities, And she says, don't do that. You know, it's hard enough for people to accept illness, much less when you use that same word to describe blight in the urban areas. You know? So she really does, I think, a good job of raising consciousness on that. Now, healing in Mark's gospel has some interesting perspectives to it, and I thought we could maybe, let me do this. Let me talk about stories first for healing stories, and then come back to a story in Mark that we can look at together. When I gave a session on this a while ago, I shared with the people reading from D.H. Lawrence. And I haven't been able to find out where this is taken from. All it has here is D.H. Lawrence Healing, and I can't find any reference to it. But it's a text I think speaks to us as modern persons. I am not a mechanism, an assembly of various sections. And it is not because the mechanism is working wrongly that I am ill. I am ill because of wounds to the soul, to the deep emotional self. And the wounds to the soul take a long, long time. Only time can help. And patience. And a certain difficult repentance, long difficult repentance, realization of life's mistake, and the freeing oneself from the endless repetition of the mistake, which humankind at large has chosen to sanctify. Now, I went back and did some study on D.H. Lawrence, and there are a number of things he could mean when he talks about that mistake of mankind. But I'd like to suggest one to you that I think comes out of my own life and certainly with the students that I deal with. And I think it's the mistake of self-hatred. There's a play that ran in Seattle called Gloria Duplex by a writer, Rebecca Wells. She writes oftentimes in the Seattle Weekly. And she is a playwright. And this is a play that came out of one of the workshops for creative playwrights. And a friend of mine, a colleague of mine from Seattle U, and I decided to go to this play for some reason. I guess I heard it was good, so I dragged her into it. And it's rather astounding. Did you get a chance to go there? I know you're from Seattle. Anyone here get a chance to go to Gloria Duplex? Well, if it's ever playing any place, it's just really a wonderful play. Very spiritual. At any rate, when you come in to the house, as they call it, there are shrines all the way around the outside of the inside of the theater, but you know. And all of these shrines are made from things that have been found on the street that have been thrown away, like a hubcap, but of course it's all polished up. Or a broken mirror, an edge of a mirror, you know. So it's all shiny objects. You'd be surprised how many shiny objects there are, you know, Coke bottles and all kinds of things, you know. And each one is, there's little altars made of this trash, is really what it is. It's trash. But it's very beautifully kind of organized. And then there's this artist person who is telling you about these things that he's put into these altars, you know, these little shrines, and he kind of points out various things as he's going along. And this is all done very seriously as he's kind of going around. And it's very strange, you know, because I didn't know if this was the beginning of the play or not, you know, but because it was like you were walking in off the street and then you saw this guy, and I didn't know if he was a player. Well, it turns out he was not the main player, but the supporting actor in this. The main player is Gloria Duplex. And Gloria Duplex is a dancer. And she has a chapel, actually, in which she does her dancing. And then there is a black woman who plays the piano. And Gloria is kind of the, pastor of this parish, you know. And we got a bulletin and the whole thing, you know, and we sang songs and you know, the whole thing was really... But as it goes on, the story that you hear, her life story comes out, is that her mother was a prostitute. And so you kind of get the fragments, the shards of her existence as she's leading you through this service. She became this exotic dancer, okay, as a way to support herself. And once, while she was dancing, she had an experience. You know, they have one of those big kind of round mirrors, you know. And in that mirror, reflected to her, was the image of Jesus. So she begins to share that she saw Jesus. She had this experience of Jesus, and it changed her life. And as it goes on, what you find out is that she thought of herself always as trash. And the experience of seeing Jesus made her realize that she was a treasure. And then she begins to put that together. And of course, that's where the shrines now go, how they fit in, because those are all pieces of people that had been discarded. In the Seattle Times last February, they had an article on crime in Seattle. And there was just this short little paragraph. It said, "Actually, people are more likely to kill themselves than to be killed by someone else." Dr. Ray's reports for King County show, for instance, that in 1988, there were 96 murders, but 217 suicides. The same pattern applies nationally. In actuality, homicide and violent assaults are still very rare events. Relative to all the other things we do, the chances of being victimized are trivially small. Which reminds me, I was talking to Joseph about this. One of the professors I work with at Seattle University said to me that 55,000 people died in Vietnam, in the war, but that over 60,000 have committed suicides. And then Joseph was, what did you say about that?
Well, so that's the low end of the spectrum. They say anywhere from 60,000 to 120,000 because they don't know how to statistically identify those that killed from single vehicle accidents.
But the number of returning Vietnam veterans that have died in these kind of... So it seems to me that we are a people, we may be the healthiest people on earth, but there's a whole other area where we are really very much in need. What have I disregarded? What have you disregarded within yourself as trash? Kind of as a question. What have you disregarded within yourself as trash? That is, where does self-hatred take hold? Remember a professor at Seattle U, or actually it was the person I told you about, it was a wonderful chaplain at the university for years, and he said, love your neighbor as yourself. He said, that's the problem. That's how we do love our neighbor. We hate ourselves and we hate our neighbor. That does begin with how we relate to ourselves. So maybe I thought we could just share a little bit. What are some of the ways in which women hate themselves? I mean, this isn't, again, it's just not personal. I mean, there's a cultural aspect to all this, culturally. So
what I keep hearing over and over again, that women literally hate their bodies. Yeah. Oh, I hate my thighs, they're so fat.
Yes.
Or I hate my breasts, they're too small.
That's right. There's a whole area. If you, any of the comics, for instance, Kathy, she just hits that over and over again, just not accepting her body as. And that, certainly that comes up with my undergraduates all the time, a real hatred of body. That's a real women's issue. That's really right. How about some other things along this line? Just culturally. It doesn't have to be something you yourself but certainly something culturally we're encouraged, areas of self-hatred.
I'm just the housewife.
All right, right. Somehow or other that the roles that we play are not good enough. So we blame ourselves and hate ourselves because we're not out there. Some others.
Blaming ourselves for what happens to our children.
Oh, yes, becoming really, so that, for, you know, taking full responsibility for their lives as if they didn't have any responsibility or being of their own, right? Blaming ourselves. So if they get into drugs, you'd rather say, it's my fault. I did it, something I did, right? Some other areas.
Or even feeling whatever we do is not enough.
Oh, yes. That's a, when you think of it, how, what a mean thing to do to yourself. But it is, it comes out of. That's good. Some other things that we may blame ourselves for, or show that we do not love ourselves, genuinely love ourselves.
Well, but what happens to kids?
You want to say?
Blame yourself.
Okay. Okay. That's all right. It can be said twice. That's a good thing. I mean, because I do think, I mean, is this generation, are we responsible for the generation behind us, and in what way? Is it our fault? I mean, I remember when I was working again with this, actually his name is Father Ken Galbraith, but he used to say the judge is always a killer. And I think of how strong oftentimes a judge is within us. So that you have an emotion, and before you've even felt it, you've judged it and repressed it, as if there's something even wrong with feelings. Huh? Any other? I think those. It's a nice little kind of selection here. I think I'm going to do one more thing here, and then I'm going to have us work in groups on two different parables and see if we can, or two different healing thing we can see. If we look at Mark, we started there at Mark chapter 1, verse 21 to 28, which is the first healing story in the Gospel of Mark. It puts us onto, I think, what is Mark in perspective on healing. You have, as it begins there, Jesus is in Capernaum, and on the Sabbath, he enters the synagogue, and what does your text say? And
taught.
Okay. But notice then what happens. It says, the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Now, if the people were astonished by his teaching, what do you think that means?
He's teaching them something new.
He's teaching them something. They're hearing something that they haven't heard before. And it seems to me what his teaching did was touch their lives. Because there is no way that you can hear something and be astonished unless somehow or other it touches you. So the authority that Jesus has is an authority that comes out of the experience that he's able to evoke in people. So he's able to draw out of them their experience. He's able to, in a way that the scribes did not. So there's a sense in which I see within that text, Jesus is already empowering them by making them, kind of connecting them, it seems to me, in the way that the scribes, so you can see the scribes kind of giving the teaching kind of to them. And here it seems as if the astonishment, the reaction of astonishment also means right away that they're involved. But some or other, his teaching involved them and evoked a response from them. Then, right out of that, it says, in the synagogue was a man with an unclean spirit. He cried out. So he's going to resist what's happening in this group. What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. Jesus rebuked him and said, quiet, come out of him. The unclean spirit convulsed him and with a loud cry came out of him. That seems to be the
thing, unclean spirit there represents a power that resists within that person. There is a resistance, and that's where to the teaching, to this new teaching. Because after all, the teaching of Jesus empowers you. In this person, then, it's a challenge to that demonic power that's within that person.
Is it the unclean spirit then that cries out, or is it the man himself?
I think it's the unclean spirit, because at this point, that's the power within this person. That's the whole point, is that his own power isn't connected or isn't there. It's actually a power within that disturbs him in the same way and disrupts this individual person the same way it now disrupts this community.
Is the man himself in that moment perceiving the difference?
I don't know, I don't know. I think, yeah, right. My own sense is, though, is that somehow or other we have to connect Jesus' teaching with this reaction of the demonic power. And what a demonic power means is simply that the person does not have control of himself. He doesn't have self-power, if you will. There's a power that is organizing him. And it's an organization that is disruptive. Anyway, then it says, all were amazed and asked one another, what is this? A new teaching with authority. Now that's what's so distinctive to the Gospel of Mark, is that Jesus is a teacher healer. Or the teaching of Jesus is what heals. That's rather amazing when you think of it. That somehow or other, the message of Jesus needs or is supposed to heal. That strikes me as really powerful within the text. Robert Moore, in this book, and I can't find the passage now, but he says, for one's spirituality to grow and develop, mature, you need to do two things. I think this is what I said. One is you have to own yourself. And that means that you have to own also your projections or your shadow side. And that's really hard, I think, because we brought up to be good. This group particularly, brought up to be good. Your ministers are supposed to be good. So it's very hard then to embrace and own your shadows. For me, too, it's very hard to do that. But so he says, those are the two, you have to do two things. One is to own yourself. And the other is to see the need for help. To see the need for help. And you didn't, you kind of said that over here. That's a really hard thing to do for many of us, is to admit our needs, to seek help when we need help. I think these healing stories are most useful for doing that. So there are two stories that I would like to have us look at, and you can choose one or the other. Let's see here.
Leper one.
Well, I was going to skip the leper one. Actually, when I did this once before, I took them out of different Gospels, but I want to stay within Mark's Gospel here. How about if we, or you can choose, in chapter 7, the healing of a deaf man. Now, I've heard it said that that's one of the most difficult disabilities, is being deaf. Oh, wait once. Yeah, right? Isn't it? I think so. That it's harder to be deaf than it is to be without sight. That somehow or other, not being able to hear really does isolate you from a community. So that would be a really, and of course, deafness is such a wonderful symbol, because a lot of us are deaf to all kinds of things, about our own person and so on. So that would be, and the question I want you to focus as you read that in your little group is, what reasons would the man have to hate himself? Since I'd like to work at that self-hatred, what reasons might he have to hate himself? So let's do that text. And
we're in 7.
That's in chapter 7 at the end. And let's do the one right before that too. So you have a choice here. Let's have some people do the Syrophoenician woman's faith, 24, verses 24 to 30. And again, let's just read that and focus on what reasons the person who is being cured would have had to hate him or herself. Let's just spend about 5-10 minutes kind of working at that and come up with a little list. Now, I want to say I'm not saying that these people hate themselves, but I think it is a legitimate way to take a healing story and put ourselves in the place of that person and see what our reaction would be to that limitation, to that illness, and to that, okay? Let's just try that for a little bit, see if that works. If that doesn't work, I have other examples. Anyway, so in little groups of maybe three, just taking that. We have about 10 minutes here, I think.
Well, I mean, it's a pressure. if they're not.
She's out of the jerk over here.
Yeah.
Well, with Jesus.
There's no mention of her.
She does call her
She has a scene in the It makes sense with the husband will see the child is the child is supposed to be a mom.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's see what you came up with. All right? All right, let's work out the Sarah Pinson. definition of women. Give me some woman. Give me some reasons that she could hate herself. Her seventh and her race, okay? She's the wrong race, she's a Gentile. Which, remember, the Jews considered pretty, you know, worthless or whatever. So it's very racist, okay? What?
She's a woman in that culture.
Being a woman, she could hate herself because of her sex.
And then she had a daughter.
Her daughter's
sex. Right.
No.
So that she could take on herself her daughter's illness, and that somehow it was her fault. Good.
It's not a son, it's a daughter.
Oh yeah, right, she had a daughter, so.
Sick
one. Not a son. Yeah, right. Bad enough she's a daughter and then she's sick. Well, you know, that is, isn't that important that you begin to get those little features in God that changes a story, doesn't it? I mean, since I've been doing this reading, gosh, all kinds of things begin to pop up at you, and I think, wow.
No husband is mentioned so much.
Right.
Why wasn't the husband requesting that?
Well, and it could well be she didn't have a husband, so now she's a widow, and right? So now she's not, right? That's another step down. So let's just say no husband. I mean, he's not there.
Well, the husband couldn't shame himself to ask for a healing for a daughter anyway.
Well, but you would think it was the husband's role because of the public nature of this.
Yeah, to visit with the rabbi, to visit with the teacher, you know.
Yeah, right. It, Jairus would have been the, I would think, the norm for a husband, but she's without. In one sense, she's shameless, isn't she?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's might have been a really runaway type, terribly disruptive girl because he found her at home in bed when she went home.
Well, you want to say that
she
again?
Found her. She might have been a very disruptive, runaway, terrible type of daughter, but she found her home in bed when she came back home.
Yeah,
and
so
everything was great.
Right, because of the cure, there's a sense in which her daughter was.
But I don't know what was wrong with
the
daughter. But she
right.
was happy at home in bed.
Yeah. But that would have been a reason for her shame. However, that in one sense that changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's
the good part. Yeah.
That would be the healing. The healing would be that somehow or other. Yeah, that's nice. Whoopsie.
It's a little tack here on the floor.
any other ideas here?
Oh,
yes.
Just to back up a little bit on
yes.
the race.
Yeah.
Thought preached a wonderful sermon a while back. The Canaanite means dog. And she equates herself to dog. And I looked this up, and no, I did a printout of all the references to dogs in the Bible and found out there is nothing good said about dogs in the Bible. Nothing.
Isn't that interesting?
And so dogs are the lowest of the low, probably even lower than pigs. And the ultimate insult is to have die in public and have your blood licked by dogs in the Bible. And so the dog is the lowest of the low, so that the thought that Christ could give the crumbs of bread, if you take this as a Eucharistic image, and feed them to the dog. Well, anyway.
that has lots of possibilities. Notice that within all of these stories, there are lots of gaps. And the reason for the gaps is really to allow the reader to come into the story. So that's how you involve, and actually requires you, in a certain sense, to fill those gaps, to let you wonder. And of course, what you fill the gaps with are your own prejudices or your own insights, your own stuff. And so even as that goes on, you learn something about yourself by how you go about reading that story.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's the familiarity of many of these stories that's our worst enemy. So somehow or other, it's making those stories live again for us. I think that's really... Mm-hmm. So like you said, that's just a wonderful thing, that kind of... With the whole dog thing, you kind of puts that all in perspective. It's wonderful. Yes, go ahead,
I was just thinking, you know... Jesus called her, referred to her as a dog, and she didn't resist that at all. She didn't say, I'm not a dog, or, you know. Instead, she just said, it wasn't, you know, if you were healthy, you would kind of resist that.
It's interesting. What would be some other reasons along that line that she might think ill of herself in a certain sense? What kind of woman is she?
She'd be a hooker.
She couldn't be a prostitute, okay. Mm-hmm. Be something. I mean, actually, she's pretty forward, isn't she?
Yeah, she went about Jesus in the house all herself. Yeah. Kind of
Some people suggest she's a real nag, you know, doesn't give up. Yes.
But it's the daughter who's sick, not the woman.
And yes. But she's making a nuisance of herself, you know. That's why, you know, there's a sense in terms of the disciples, what might they be saying about her?
But if she's sick, her daughter's likely to be sick too.
That's an interesting interpretation.
She must have, if she was, I think she was very witty, the way she was able to get some of that retort, and intelligent and all that, which must have been very difficult for her to fit into her, her society, where she was expected to subvert all that.
And would have been put down for it.
If she couldn't control herself and always came up with these witty retorts.
That's wonderful. There are a number of people who really suggest that she changes Jesus' mind.
Yeah, doesn't Jesus show some shame here by changing his mind? You know, self-hatred of his own.
Owens, maybe his shadow as a Jew, who doesn't have as much respect for the Gentiles, and she shames him into it in a certain sense. Some people really see this as a story that catches Jesus up short. Mm-hmm. And I say this to my students, I hope this isn't heretical, but certainly if we say Jesus is human, then he has to have a shadow. It's one thing to say, see, sin is something else, but it seems to me that Jesus, as a human being, has a shadow. I mean, he has limitations. He can't be so above his culture that he's not part of his culture. So it's within that culture, and his culture, of course, was that was controlled by clean, unclean. It was racist, certainly, in the way it dealt with that. And he reflects that in his response, and then he comes around and gives that wonderful response. Now, in that story itself, if you were looking for the meaning of this, say, the daughter's illness, what might you come up with as the meaning for her, or the purpose for her daughter's illness? I mean, why was this daughter sick? Why was she? I'm not looking for a biomedical reason now.
Are you talking about the culture?
All right, within the culture, but even I'm saying within this Jesus story, what might Jesus say is the reason for this daughter's illness?
The mother's projection to the daughter.
Okay, now you're giving me again that might be within that culture, okay? Mm-hmm. But I'm saying within the gospel perspective.
Well, isn't this the point where Jesus' ministry changes?
Okay. In other words, what you have is an illness that plays this wonderful role in Jesus' own ministry. So it gives you a meaning for illness that is not negative, but rather is a part of the unfolding mystery of God. So it's a way in which we, when illness comes to us, it need not be something awful, but it can be the source of good. Now, I'm not saying that now you should all get out and, you know, get ill or sick. If you just live, you're going to be ill. But somehow or other, there's a way of seeing that within that illness comes opportunity.
Could you explain a little bit more how Jesus' ministry exactly changed?
Well, within the Gospel of Mark, this becomes a change when he goes out to the Gentiles. And it's after that, or it's at least related, you know, it has something to do with the Sea of Galilee and how is on this side and feeds the crowds. This is the Jewish side. And then he crosses the lake and goes to the Gentile side and he feeds them over there. Okay. So what he's doing is he is breaking the boundaries between the races. And then this story becomes... I must say to you, again, we have to remember this isn't a historical account. This author, the author of this gospel is himself constructing this. But think of it as if this gospel is for a community in Rome, it would have been living in a circumstance where the community itself had both Jewish and Gentile Christians living within it. So it needed stories that would help them cope with what would have been really very difficult. I mean, I think we underestimate what a challenge that was for the first century, and how they had all of the issues we have And the stories then are so potent for us dealing with those same issues of racism and classism and sexism and ageism. I mean, all of those things that we cover. But I think it's just wonderful to see a story here where her illness is the, you know, serves a purpose, if you will, in God's plan. Okay, now, how about the deaf man? What reasons might a deaf man have to hate himself?
Unable to communicate.
What?
Unable to communicate.
Right.
And you're really almost totally dependent upon others.
Oh, God, that's a good one, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And having only women to take care of him.
We don't know that, do we?
What made you say that in the text? Or would that,
well,
were you thinking just that would be the natural?
Yeah, that would just be the natural thing, you know. What would be his needs and how would he get help for those needs, you know, from a man?
And I suppose it would really depend upon his mother and his sisters, perhaps.
Yeah.
And he would never then be part of a male. Again, you know, there are enough gaps in the text that you can fill that in, you know. I always draw my students back to, you know, is it in the text, you know, where is it, where do you think the gap is so that we don't get too far astray here. But nevertheless, it's an interesting exercise. Any other reason?
Is it possible that this would also be difficult because the community would look upon his having this problem because of the gods being angry or you know,
The cultural explanation.
Uh-huh.
Saying if you say somehow or other is this connected with sin, then it gives him a reason to hate himself.
It also brings shame on his family.
Oh yes, that's excellent. Oh, that's good. We kind of forgot about that, didn't we? But that'd be a real shame issue.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
So he could really hate himself for that reason. How about where it says that his speech was.
Kind of his,
but he kind of has bad speech, obviously, because he can't, you know, his hearing problem. So, that, do you ever hear someone, you know, who has that? It kind of frightens you because the sounds sound almost animal-like. You know? So what someone would stop to do is, I mean, there'd be good reason to hate themselves because they don't sound like everyone else.
Well, not just the inability to communicate, but the inability to understand.
Right.
It's hard to separate. Well, I'm, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Am I stupid because I can't understand?
Yes, and there are stories like that of children, for instance, who were thought that they were stupid and actually they had a hearing problem. And you see the importance of hearing. So I think that's a good one of maybe being thought of as stupid because he was deaf. Could some other reason?
Don't all of these come from the fact, though, that he didn't feel them himself, that they were all a manifestation of the culture ostracizing him?
Okay. I'll say some more. You mean all of these would be?
Yes.
Well, maybe one I was also thinking of, I don't know what kind of covered in the other, is that he would have no function in society.
Yeah.
Apart from being dependent, he would also have no function. So the community might do it to him, but he also would judge himself because he has no function.
Right. He has no place of being for him.
Yeah, we talked about him almost being a non-person.
Yes. Yes. That's very, very good. But one could blame oneself for being isolated. I think that's one of the things that happens, is that when someone treats you badly, the tendency is to internalize that and say that I'm being treated badly because I'm a bad person. You know? I mean, children start this very early on because, again, that importance of mirroring. You know? So when someone looks at you and looks like you're really stupid, you feel stupid because that's actually what they're saying to you in a certain sense as you look at them and they mirror that back. And I don't think we really hold on to that long enough to realize how really dependent we are on that kind of affirmation. And then how Jesus could have changed that. In other words, how did this man see himself as Jesus mirrored him back to himself? How did that change? And the importance of hearing for the message. Because all of these things have then that metaphorical meaning underneath it. And so hearing becomes a really Christian symbol. Remember the bishop, actually the cardinal, Sin of the Catholic cardinal in the Philippines. He's very active in the politics there and so on. And right at the time when they were in so much upheaval and so on, it was when President Reagan was president. And Cardinal Sin had an appointment made with him, and they were in the same hotel, as it turned out, I guess. And I guess he didn't have an appointment. The way it went is that the president found out that Cardinal Sin was in the same hotel at the same time, and so made contact whether they could get together for breakfast or something like that, because he's a really important person in the Philippines. Yeah. So what Cardinal Sin to us, he came to see us right after that. He had a talk at CLU, and he said, Karen, he's deaf. I mean, he's not just deaf, he's deaf. Because he wasn't hearing what he was saying as a Filipino bishop, cardinal of that country, and what he was trying to share about his people. And so there is a cultural deafness that all of us really have. And so it's a really, you can see what a wonderful story it is and how much we can really pull out of that. Well, you do well. Gosh, you're good. I think we need to probably stop here. But thank you very much. Thank you, yes, thank you.